Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You are listening to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, salam, and welcome to this episode of the Hadith of the Day. Today we reflect on a fascinating description from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his holy progeny, about mu'mins and munafiqs, like the believers and hypocrites. The believer is cheerful and playful, while the hypocrite is frowning and angry. Frowning and angry. So at first glance, this may surprise you. Why would the Prophet describe a believer as playful? But behind these words is a deep wisdom about faith, character, and how we bring light into the world. A true believer carries hope, trust in God, and inner peace. This naturally makes them cheerful. They may face hardships, but their heart is not chained by despair. That inner light shows on their face in smiles, kindness, and positive energy. Modern psychology confirms this. Research shows that people who live with faith and gratitude tend to be more optimistic and resilient. Their positivity even strengthens their immune system. A believer's cheerfulness is not shallow. It's rooted in the trust in Allah. And the hadith also says the believer is la'ib, playful. This doesn't mean careless, but balanced. Yeah, the Prophet himself had such a good sense of humor, sometimes with Imam Ali alayhi salam, who was, out of all people, he spent more of his time with Imam, with Prophet Muhammad. And neuroscience shows that playfulness reduces stress, boosts creativity, and strengthens relationships. A believer knows when to be serious, but also when to relax and bring joy to others. This balance prevents rigidity and burnout. You know that in some other narrations, it says that the true believer hides the, depression, or hides actually the sadness, and shows a kind of happiness on his face. In contrast, the hypocrite is described as frowning and angry. Why? Because hypocrisy creates inner conflict. A hypocrite hides their real self, and that tension spills out as irritability and negativity. Their heart is heavy with envy or dishonesty, so their face reflects it. Studies in behavioral psychology show that suppressed guilt or hidden agendas often express themselves through hostility or constant criticism. In other words, what's inside eventually shows outside. So the Prophet teaches us that faith is not gloom, it is light, cheerfulness, and balance. The believer expresses hope, not heaviness. The hypocrite, tapped in dishonesty, carries frowns and anger. So let us choose the believer's path, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Salam to all tuning in. This is Iran Radio, broadcasting from the beating heart of Tehran. I'm here to welcome you into a world of conversation, culture, and insight. Iran Radio presents some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. The word Bismillah appears 114 times in the Quran. It occurs twice in chapter An-Naml, whereas chapter Tawbah is the only surah which does not begin with Bismillah. Quran believes in life after death, and the Quran teaches us that besides having a body, a human being also has a spirit, a soul. And when a person dies, the physical body vanishes, while the soul remains. Coming up now, another captivating segment of radio productions. Then it's time for Youth Station, a program created for young minds, navigating modern life through an Islamic lens. Topics include faith, friendships, personal style, prayer, and finding a shared identity in today's world. Next, don't miss Spotlight. So stick around, there's more to come.
Welcome back to The Voice of the Wall. My guest today is Professor Ilan Pape, one of the most prominent and provocative historians of the modern Middle East. He is the director of the European Center for Palestinian Studies at the University of Exeter and is best known for his groundbreaking work on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, including his books The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine and Lobbying for Zionism. His latest book, Israel on the Brink, offers a sobering diagnosis of what he sees as seven internal cracks threatening the future of the Israeli state, while also tracing the deeper historical, ideological, and geopolitical forces that have shaped its path. Ilan, thank you very much for joining me on The Voices of War.
It's a great pleasure to be on The Voice of War in the program. Thank you very much for having me. Great.
It's been a long time coming, so I'm very grateful that we finally be able to lock it in. You, as well as other prominent thinkers like Professor Mirshana, have drawn very strong links between AIPAC, the Zionist lobby writ large, Israeli politicians, along with U.S. neocons, to push the agenda of initially, obviously, the Iraq war, but then subsequent wars as well. And many big thinkers actually attribute most of the wars in the Middle East over the past 25 or so years to this kind of same tension or the same push from the blending of the neocons with the Zionists. Can you just elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yeah, I take a bit somewhat different view on this in a way, and I think there's a difference between American imperialist impulses that the lobby is not responsible. I mean, that's the certain American way of thinking of what should be America's role in the world, and I don't think you can pin it on the lobby. With this I agree with Noam Chomsky, who says that this is the main push for American. After all, the Israeli lobby is not responsible for what the Americans did in the Philippines, in Southeast Asia, in Central America, South America. I mean, there is an American imperialist impulse, very yeah. strong one. It has nothing to do with the lobby. However, when it comes to Israel itself and the area around Israel, that's when the lobby is effective in convincing the American imperialists American imperialist interests are best served through Israel. The Israelis are really panicking for what they saw yesterday on the White House. When President Trump says Saudi Arabia is as important to us as Israel, which is exactly what he said. He said they're as important as Israel. Israel is not more important than Saudi Arabia. This is a moment, you never know with Trump. I mean, you don't know if there's any substance behind his statement, but let's say it is a substantial statement. Let's say it's not even a whimsical kind of utterance, that it's part of a possible strategic idea of how America's world would look like, America's involvement in the Middle East would look like in the next decade or two. That means that the imperialist impulse is not based necessarily on a strong alliance with Israel. It's maybe based on a strong alliance with Arab states that are pro-American. It creates much less problem if you think about it. The Saudis, of course, nobody cares about civil rights and human rights records, but it's easier to overlook the violation of human rights, civil rights in Saudi Arabia. It's not easy to overlook the violations of the Palestinian rights by Israel. And that could be
well, it's one journalist,
challenge.
One journalist that's really... sorry to interrupt. There was one journalist... Jamal Khashoggi, that really draws some heat, between MBS and Trump in the recent press.
Absolutely. And America always say dictators are fine as long as they are our dictators. The point is that the lobby, if the lobby would face an America that says yes, we still want to be a dominant power in the world and in your neighborhood in the Middle East, but you know what? We don't need you. Then the lobby would find it very difficult to be effective, I think. So it's a cynical way of looking at the future by which you understand, and I always say it in the book, my last book, as an historian, the ability to relieve people from oppression and occupation is not always achieved by a pure, just moral struggle. Sometimes it is being achieved by more cynical development, on which you have very little influence, but have an impact on your life, whether you are enthusiastic about these changes or not. It doesn't matter. At the end of the day, it can create a different reality, similar to the impact of the end of the Cold War on the chances of toppling the apartheid regime in South Africa. It was a very important development without which the apartheid would have lingered on for a while if the Cold War would have not ended and the Soviet Union would have not collapsed.
So how do you see then the current situation in the U.S.? I mean, obviously with Trump, we don't really know what's going to happen next. But it's without a shadow of a doubt, I think the civil society, in fact his base, is hugely split. And the single issue that's splitting his base is Israel. You know, not least because of Gaza, but also the amount of money that U.S. sends to Israel. You know, many openly say that U.S. is run by Israel because of these kind of blind loyalty to Netanyahu and his government. But also things like the assassination of Charlie Kirk, there's, you know, competing narratives, all of which somehow center around U.S. support for Israel or, you know, Mossad's influence in the U.S. And, of course, probably the biggest one is Epstein, which, you know, of course there are issues and questions of who is guilty on both sides of the aisle in the U.S., but there's an overarching narrative there, especially now that we're hearing as of today, the most likely we won't see the files released despite it passing House and Senate, and Trump will most likely sign it because of national security implications. And many are drawing, some better than others, conclusions that the national security risk really is the expose of a foreign intelligence service, i.e. Mossad, having played a key part in, you know, the propping up of Epstein. How do you view that from your perspective?
Well, I think it's important to remember that the source of power for AIPAC is the Capitol Hill, not the White House. There were presidents that AIPAC didn't like. Jimmy Carter, Barack Obama, George Bush Sr., to mention the three most courageous presidents. At least facing some of AIPAC's pressure. Even Reagan had a clash with AIPAC. So the source of power is not the White House. The source of power is Capitol Hill. And until we don't hear different voices from there, presidents come and go. The lobby in the Capitol Hill stays. You have to pay attention to Capitol Hill. That's where the source of power for AIPAC and the other sections of the lobby exists. So all these developments that you rightly described, we need to see if they are reflected in the change of attitude in Capitol Hill, not in the White House. Now, I do believe that you're right, that a younger generation of Republicans would be much more isolationist in terms in the context of Israel, namely there would be a limit to how much money they think the United States should invest in sustaining Israeli policies and adventures. I think we should pay attention to the younger Democratic generation. They already have shown in the municipal elections last week their ability to even win in places which traditionally were kind of blue-collar people, blue-collar workers were voting either for Trump. So I think, yes, that there is a trend in the society that would distances the United States from Israel. But I haven't seen yet its impact on Capitol Hill, you know, on the decision taken by either the House of Representatives or the Senate. But I do believe it will happen. I do believe that these are very slow processes. We have to remember that the lobby is still connected to the arms lobby, to the multinational corporation that still see Israel as a good investment for high-tech, pharmaceutical technologies, and of course security and military industries. We should not underestimate the importance of these powerful lobbies to join forces with the lobby of Israel. But again, the question is, do these lobbies need Israel if indeed the Arab world is going to provide a much better and easier market or collaboration, you know? I think the bottom line of what we are talking about is, A, not to take a determinist view on American policy. Also, historically, I can show that it was not always, as people think, totally anti-Palestinian and pro-Israeli. So let's not take a determinist view on it. Secondly, there are all kinds of possible scenarios, one through a more progressive democratic success, one through maybe less attractive to me, but a more isolationist Republican success. Either way, it's part of the same, you know, matrix of processes that lead us to think that the position of Israel becomes much more vulnerable and precarious as we look into a more distant future.
So do you place the recent purchase of things like TikTok and the, you know, installation of prominent Zionists in, you know, CBS News, in the U.S., do you see that as part of that tactic to try and reassert itself amongst the younger audiences? Because I think that's where they've really lost the support.
Yeah, and it won't work. They will fail. Because TikTok, in the end of the day, is a means to a goal. It's not the goal itself. It's just a vehicle. And the passengers determine the direction of the trip, not the manufacturer of the car, so to speak. So I don't think it will work. I think this is like the tough legislation against BDS. All that is a fight back. Of course, they're fighting back for their power. I don't think they even fight back anymore for Israel. I think that's what I write in the book. I said that the lobby became a powerful organization that seeks power for the sake of power. I don't think they're even working for Israel anymore. They enjoy decades and decades of being so powerful, they don't want to lose it. And that's why, by the way, as I show in the book, the more conscientious members of AIPAC in the early 1990s began to leave the organization because they felt that this is not working for Israel, that this was working for the lobby itself. So I really don't I know it's very difficult to convince people because they seem so powerful. They buy this and they buy that, and they dominate this organization, the other. Yes, this is the last battle, and it's a fierce battle. But I do believe it's doomed to fail. Like so many acts in history where things that the campaigns based on populism, coercion, power, for a while are very successful because they intimidate, they terrify people, and they destroy. So it's easier to destroy than to build. In the long run, they're not sustainable. And we have to believe that they're not sustainable.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the whole human society, the whole globe is in danger if these things are sustainable for life. Yeah.
I think that speaks to the point from your recent interview with Mehdi Hassan, that history is not history is cyclical rather than linear. And I think as a historian, I think we should heed that. But can you just unpack that a little bit more? What do you mean by history is cyclical rather than linear?
Yeah, I mean that we were there before, not in the same way, but we were there before in ages, in an age where populism, cynical politics, expansionist empires, political and economic elite that disregarded the main concerns of their societies. We were there before, and they fell. They fell when eventually people had enough and created a different kind of politics. And this will return. And you can already see it. You know, when millions of people demonstrate for Palestine in the last 2 years, they don't only demonstrate for Palestine. They demonstrate for a different kind of politics in their own country because there is a connection in their eyes for the immoral position on Palestine and the immoral position on ecological justice, poverty, immigration, you know, all the things that they realize two things, and you can see it from the discourse and the impulse that brings them to the kind of the center of the city, if you want to demonstrate. One is that not one country can solve the real issues that face the world, whether it's global warming, poverty, wars, and so on. This is not something one state or even an empire can take upon itself. You need global cooperation. And for global cooperation, you need the global justice system, which we don't have, and hopefully we will have. And Gaza proved that we don't have a universal international justice. So that's the first thing. The second thing, that they see the connection between the lack of interest of their politicians in the issues that I just mentioned, the other injustices, and their immoral position on Palestine. And I think that creates in me the hope that, because I do believe that the issues are much bigger than Palestine and concern everyone on the globe, I have to believe that humanity has the power to go back again, as it did again and again in history, and, you know, try at least to open a different chapter in the relation between what we do and the fate of our globe, our ecology, our societies, and not only base our politics on self-interest with very little care for other people, their aspiration, and the quality of life.
Just on that point, you've in your book Israel on the Brink, you actually towards the end you take up an issue with capitalism, which I just wanted to build on a little bit. I recently interviewed a prominent Balkan security analyst, Zlatko Hadžidejić,
yes,
who's built his career on the link between capitalism and nationalism. You know, builds on the thinking of thinkers like Gellner and Anderson, the Imagine Communities.
Yeah.
He builds on their thinking that nationalism and capitalism are very closely intertwined, and his prediction, at least given the current state of affairs, is that in our hyper-capitalized world, we require authoritarianism. I wonder how that sits with you and whether you see some links between what you're saying, especially given what you've talked about the economic troubles that are that Israel faces, but of course much of the world, especially the West, faces anyway.
Yeah, I do think that, capitalism has many versions. You should not lump them all together, but I think the kind of capitalism,
of course, yeah,
yeah, that is evolving
of today, yeah,
yeah, exactly. Recently, is very much based on this idea that economic interests of the few and not of the many are the compass that leads to decision taken, whether to support Israel, whether to invest in Gaza, whether to invest in global warming or in fossilized energy. You know, all these decisions are driven by the question of profit, not by question of the welfare or even the survival and sustainability of the globe, which is incredible. So yes, now, because you can see the direct connection here, as I said before. To change that kind of attitude, you need a global cooperation. Nationalism usually is one of the most important impediments for global cooperation. So nationalism says, I don't care about the situation of the water, the quality of the air in the neighboring country. I don't care about the violation of human rights, civil rights in Palestine, 3,000 kilometers far away from where I live. All I care, and I may even be care, do something about these things in my own country in the name of nationalism, but that would be ineffective. It would have no impact, even if there is a genuine wish among capitalists to solve some of these problems. They cannot do it because they are so tied in with nationalism, absolutely. And I think the role of the left is to bring back the idea of universalism, but in a different form than they did in the past, because they need to be connected to indigenous people, to traditions, for people's respect for religion and tradition and so on, all kinds of things that were cast away by the left, unfortunately, in the 60s and the 70s of the last century. So there is a way of creating a different kind of, a different essence of politics that has to include a different version of economic and social justice compared to what capitalists are offering us.
Which is a huge challenge.
Absolutely.
Because it's not just changing one country, two countries, it's changing an entire ecosystem that's been developed over the past.
Well, we need intersectionality. All these struggles, I mean, all these struggles need intersectionality. They need to be united. They cannot be localized. They have to be globalized, because also the local balance of power is usually against the minority, the oppressed, and so on. So the only way to empower it is by globalizing.
So conscious of our time, and I know we've only got a couple of minutes, but what I do really want to ask you is the fifth crack you identify is the Israeli army invincible. So after decades of projecting this invincibility, how has the IDF actually performed in Gaza, Lebanon, and of course with Iran? You know, is this a myth that's now being challenged?
Well, a little bit it is. You have to remember, the Israeli army was very successful on three accounts. When the war was short, when it was fought on the other side's territory, and when Israel initiated the war. All these three elements were not there on the 7th of October. And it seems that when you are engaged in a long war that at first is being fought on your own soil, and you are not the one who initiated it, that even vis-a-vis a small guerrilla army like Hamas, you find it very difficult to win. Imagine what would have happened if Hezbollah would have joined forces with Hamas on the 7th of October. We don't know how it would unfold. And we definitely don't know how this army would be able to deal with conventional armies should the attitude of Arab neighbors of Israel change. In other words, a message to the Israelis is that yes, you have huge air power, which works very well against the ghetto of Gaza, and maybe also against Iran with the help of the American Air Force. But eventually you have to think about conventional wars that are not only won by air force and so on. And most important with anything, and with this I would end, because I think that's the most important thing that I'm saying for me, that I want to say in the book. The message even of the opposition in Israel, not just the government, is that the next 50 years would be the same. You have to fight all the time, and you have to win all the time. This is a terrible message, which explains why anyone in Israel who has the ability to leave is leaving. Because, it's, you know, in terms of statistics, it's quite possible that you won't win all the time. And they already got a taste for one day of not winning. I do hope, I'm still hopeful about it, that maybe it's a post-traumatic reaction, that at least a more significant number of Israeli Jews would learn the right lesson from the 7th of October, which is you can't do it through violence, you can't win through wars. The army is not the vehicle for the survival of a society. And you're lucky, because I do believe that the basic impulse of the Palestinians is to share the land with you peacefully. Unfortunately, your basic impulse as an ideological society is to replace the Palestinians. And until they don't change this perspective, they are risking not only the lives of the Palestinians, but also their own life in the future.
Absolutely. On that note, Ilan, I know our time's out.
Sorry about that.
Thank you very much. This was
thank you.
Not
thank
at all. I thoroughly okay. enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
A white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains. Just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. Women and children alike, murdered and massacred night after night. While the so-called leaders of countries afar debated on who's wrong or right. But their powerless words were in vain, and the bombs fell down like acid rain. Through the tears and the blood and the pain, you could still hear that voice through the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go Gaza tonight. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in the night without a fight. We will not go down in Gaza tonight.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamic.
Islamic.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
Rahman al-Rahim. Welcome to this episode of Youth Station. My name is Muhammad and I am here with Sister...
This is Nahid, having the honor of being with you.
Assalamu alaikum, Sister Nahid. We are talking about the disposable culture in our youths, in between amongst us, the Gen Zs. And we did talk about boundaries the last time.
Yeah.
And we did believe that there is no yes or no answer to this, but it depends on the situation. Exactly what are our boundaries? That's like the most conflicting discussion. Should I keep this or should I throw this away? What really makes me decide either of the two? Should I fix it or should I get a new one? What really makes me decide between these two? What is that line, that thin line between me saying yes to it or no to it? And we did talk about, for example, toxic relationships. If you think that's really toxic and you can't fix it, it's fine. Move on. Yeah, it's there is no problem in saying no to a relationship which you can't. That's why, although it's like extremely discouraged, it's displeasureful, it's not something that you might like. That's why we have the door of, for example, in marriages, divorce. If you really can't fix that marriage, fine, you can. But it should be your last resort. Try to fix it as much as you can. Blocking harmful content. Well, you know it's a harmful thing. A specific music, a specific video, a specific, you know, person who gives lectures on things that you know he's a harmful person. Avoid it, block it. There is no problem with that. But then we understand the two extremes. We know that this extreme is extremely bad. We were talking about the other end. We talked about treating people like replaceable apps. Now, this end, of course, you shouldn't treat people as if they're apps you can easily replace. Avoiding discomfort or repair in general. Now, let me challenge with another thing while we're at it. Losing patience with imperfect or imperfect things in
people. And this is happening. The young people today are not patient enough with the opposite idea, with the even they cannot defend themselves well, and it's really sad. As part of my class, always since I teach them language, as part of my class, I have this ritual, this routine, that whatever question I ask my students, there's a why after it.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is that a few years ago, I realized that our students, even in the diploma exam, I mean, even in the moment that they should be, as if they can talk about every perspective, they should be able to know the language, and even in their own mother language. Once we question the new generation with why, or defend yourself, or talk about your idea, or prove it right, they fade. They don't want to, or they don't know how to.
Just impatient.
Yeah. And
simply impatient.
Yeah, they don't want us to just tell them why. They don't want us to ask them questions, because they are unable to just tolerate the negative idea or tolerate the facial expression which shows I'm shocked by what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
So this is happening, and we see lots of young people who don't want to assert how they feel, or they just want to keep safe by just being patient with the things that they believe in. And once it comes to the other people, impatient, intolerable, and they wouldn't even just spill one word of the thing that they are thinking about, because they don't want to be tolerant with the opposing ideas.
I think this is extremely important in families as well. We talked about, we had a few episodes about parents and expecting things from parents. It's also important that we be patient in our relationships, both in with our children, with our spouse, with our parents, with our other relatives amongst us. We have to be patient with them, because there are certain things you can fix about them. Yeah, there are certain things you can't fix about them. But there are certain things that for the things that you can't fix about them, tolerate it. That doesn't make them necessarily a bad person, because there are things that you need to fix yourself in your life.
And with it comes the discipline, I think. I mean, at school once I asked one of the students who was 10 years old, he hated school. And I told him, why do you hate school? He said, because I have to stay here for the day. I have to be here for some hours. See how impatient these people are, that the youngest, say, member of the society says, I don't want to tolerate this atmosphere. I don't want to be kept here. And this concept of discipline comes with it.
Mm-hmm.
And those who feel like, okay, once I feel safe the whole time, I'm going to be more successful.
Exactly.
This is the wrong kind of idea.
And I think it all comes back again with us being patient and tolerant and sacrificial. And once again, the family issue is something that is really bothering me, because you see the rate of divorces these days, and it's something that really bothers any sound mind.
It's like the blocking culture is happening in the families.
Exactly. The disposable culture is now among the spouses.
Right.
Now, I speak to some of my teachers who are basically consultants for family affairs, and they tell me that you'd be astonished at some of the reasons why young couples, they come to us and they tell us why is the reason that they want to get the divorce. For example, this guy, when he comes home, he does not put his clothes in the right place. Or this, my wife, she doesn't cook food properly. Come on, what is this? This is bare impatience. This is bare, the bare minimum of living with someone, you know, is tolerating certain mistakes, even mistakes that they don't accept.
Once you married them, you had to know that person's not going to be perfect.
Exactly, and just like you're not perfect. Just like you're not perfect.
Yeah.
There are no two perfect persons in the world. Except for the infallibles, we learn from them how to tolerate each other. When one person becomes two, there are two opinions, there are two cultures, there are two favorites. There are two different things. There are two opinions.
Yeah,
they're completely different.
Yeah, in the simplest way, two human beings, two different people.
Exactly. So they both of them have minds. Both of them have thought processes that should be, you know, respected. Both of them go through difficulties in their life. You know, the sister who is at the home might be going through difficulties that the man who is working in the workplace is not going through, and likewise vice versa. The person who is working in the workplace might be going through difficulties that the sister might not be imagining. Understand each other, appreciate each other. Whenever the anger crouches into your life, encroaches in your life, put it down, take a step back, think about it, be tolerant. Yes, he might be wrong, she might be wrong, fine. You were wrong many times as well. Just tolerate it. Even if you can't fix it. Those situations which you can sit down and talk, perfect, ideal. Sit down, talk, get this done, get this through. It's perfect. But in those situations where either of them are stubborn, or both of them are stubborn,
bear it.
Bear it. It's fine. You don't have to have a perfect spouse. There is no such thing as whatever I tell him or her, she's going to listen or he's going to listen. It's fine. Tolerate it. It's okay for you to not have the perfect food with the one-star, two-star Michelin food coming to your plate. It's okay if the guy does not listen to you when you tell him to put his clothes in the right place or whatever the case is. It's very naive for you to now be married and then come back. And I think this is something extremely important we should tolerate as young couples, because we see the divorce rate in the generation before us as close to zero.
Yeah,
like how many times have you seen parents and grandparents, you know, you heard from them, okay, that person divorced. It's very, you know, probably cases whereby it's deserving to get divorced. But now, very simple things, just because of intolerance.
Yeah, and on the other side of the coin, we have this emotional avoidance as well. We see people even not daring to start a relationship, even not daring to marry, because they are afraid.
Exactly.
What if the person I will marry will not accept my ideas? What if one day he will come home and say something that I don't like? How am I going to react? Am I going to end the relationship off the cuff? Or am I going to bear it? How am I going to bear it? So we have this scare as well. Many of the young people today, not all of them, but many of them are scared of this emotional bond, because they avoid it, because they're scared of the moments that they have to be tolerant of each other, the moments that they have to sometimes forget about what they believe in or just try to get along with the other party.
Exactly. So let's talk more about the boundaries, because we challenged the boundaries with a lot of phrases, with a lot of scenarios.
Yeah, sure.
Let's talk more about the boundaries between disposing things and keeping things, inshallah, after we take a short break. Don't go away.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back, and let's move on to the boundaries. What are the boundaries, and how can I define my limitations, say, the things that are going to define my understanding of this culture. If we say we cannot answer the question as if this ideology, this mindset is either good or bad, so how am I going to define it for myself to take advantage of it? Okay.
Exactly. Should I throw it or should I keep it? What really makes that decision? And let me challenge you. Let me put out some more challenging scenarios. The consumer culture. It trains us to upgrade rather than, you know, fix that thing. Keep getting the most latest model. You find your computer, it's fine, working for you, good. Should you spend more money on the upgrade? Even if you have it.
The
even
money?
You have the money. You have the abundance,
but
right?
But why would I change it?
That's the question. Why would you change it? It's a more upgradable model. You're moving from not specific. I'm not going to name any brands because I don't want to bring in any further discussions or further debates. But phone A to phone B, phone 16 to phone 17.
Yeah.
This crazy culture of there is one level above this. I'm waiting. Let me get that one. It came out just recently. Let me get that one. Is that a good culture per se? Upgrading when you have the abundance, you have that money. Should you keep upgrading? Is that something necessarily good?
Not necessarily. No, never. We sometimes need stuff and we go for them. But this, I have harsh criticism regarding this idea that many, even children learn today that you have to change your phone from this to that. My students keep asking me in the class, teacher, what is your phone? Oh, that phone came out. Why didn't you go for this one? Why didn't you change it to the new one? I mean, even children and kids know today that they have to go for the best ranks, for the best brands. They have to keep upgrading. But why? I mean, my question is has been always this, why?
Why can't we just be, let's look at both the scenarios, both the sides. Why can't we just be content and satisfied with what we have until it no longer satisfied our needs, than to just, you know, crazily and, you know, extremely anxiously go after upgrading. Take a look at both the sides. There is a new upgraded thing, but this, what I have is looking after my needs perfectly.
Yeah, it's still working.
Yeah, so there is no problem in that. And this new thing is, I'm just putting more money into it. Right?
And some people do need the upgraded version. Like if my job is something that has to be done by the phone, for example, or with the laptop, and I have to keep upgrading because I have to be upgrading my job.
Mm-hmm.
So it's accepted in this case.
You know where we really get that conflict is when we think about the progress, human progress, technological progress. It's actually driven by the sales that happen in the market. So let's say a phone company brings in phone X, and then let me give a number to it, phone 12. And then for a year they have invested in their R&D and their research and development. And then they bring in phone 13 now, right? They've upgraded from one to the other. Now, what if everybody stays with that phone 12 and does not go buy the phone 13? That company will basically dilute, will basically go bankrupt because they're not having any sales. Now, this, why I brought this up is because this culture is not necessarily only for consumers, Gen Z consumers, but it's a general societal culture, and this needs to change. And you know how socially this affects? Take a look at people who look at other people, and they see that they're upgrading and they're somewhat improving in the apparent part of it. If you look at the shell of it, they're improving. And they might have the abundance of wealth to do so, but you don't. And this person who doesn't is constantly in that state of, how I wish I had that much money. I wish I had this.
Yeah.
I wish I had
and
that.
And social media is
exactly this social culture is going to not only stop between the companies and the consumers upgrading, but it's going to encroach into people who are not upgrading and say, maybe I should do so. And they are now under pressure, both in terms of wealth, both in terms of other aspects of their life, just for the sake of upgrading, they upgrade.
Yeah, exactly. As you truly mentioned it, we have to keep this balance, this education, this mindset, this literacy, that not everything that is upgraded, that is called to be new, has to be necessarily mine. We have to keep this literacy that once we need something, we can go for it, or unless we can just forget about them.
And I think we did enlist a lot of challenges in this episode, and we did clearly draw the line between what should be a disposable and what should not be disposable. Whatever is fixable, we should try our best to do so. And this consumer culture needs to change, not only on the consumer level, but entire society.
Right.
Both the businesses and the consumers need to take heed that, you know, being content with what we have, there's a lot more to be said. And unfortunately, we're way out of our limit in terms of time. Inshallah, maybe, we're not sure. Maybe if we do have the opportunity and the tawfiq, we'll definitely touch on this topic in another episode, inshallah. For now, we will bid you farewell. Thank you for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about this.
Discuss that, inshallah, in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum wa
rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of
internet. The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Israel's near daily airstrikes on Lebanon, which have killed many civilians despite a ceasefire in place, are heightening fears of a wider war. Beirut warns that a full-scale Israeli attack may be imminent as regional and international actors have sounded the alarm as well. Analysts caution that without urgent diplomacy, the confrontation could spiral into a devastating and widespread regional conflict.
Lebanon's foreign minister has warned of imminent all-out Israeli attack on the Arab country. Youssef Raji said Beirut has received warnings from Arab and international parties that Israel is preparing for a large-scale military operation against Lebanon. He said Lebanon is intensifying diplomatic contacts to shield the country and its vital facilities from the potential strikes. The remarks come in the wake of a fresh round of Israeli airstrikes on Lebanese soil. On Friday, regime's warplanes carried out at least a dozen attacks across the country. The regime claimed that the attacks targeted Hezbollah sites and rocket launchers. However, witnesses said the strikes hit civilian sites and open fields. Despite the ceasefire agreement signed between Israel and Lebanon in November 2024, Israeli airstrikes have continued almost daily, with little respite. The regime also maintains troops in five areas in South Lebanon. This persistent aggression has sparked international condemnation, particularly from the United Nations. A UN report published this month revealed that at least 127 Lebanese civilians, including children, have been killed since the ceasefire took effect. The UN has characterized these ongoing strikes as potential war crimes. Many believe that the attacks aim at pressuring Hezbollah movement to lay down its arms and reach a new deal with the Lebanese government. However, the group has ruled out any new agreement with Israel, saying that intimidation will not change Hezbollah's stance of resistance.
It says U.S. and Israel's calls for disarmament are designed to weaken Lebanon and leave it exposed to external aggression. Analysts warned that the escalating confrontation